countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
Now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, the madness of TikTok videos while driving tractors. We visit the barracks in Roscommon where John McGahern lived, how to make the perfect speech, and Brenda visits a woman fostering for the first time.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, this wet, wintry May Saturday morning where we are, I hope it's a little bit better where you are, and particularly if you've finished the darkness into light walk or run from around the country. But we're going to begin this morning with this, because as we look for ways to reduce the contamination of waterways from pesticides, a pilot scheme in mid-county Monaghan working with farmers is aiming to just do that. I'm on my way to Baird's Shore, a lake outside Bally Bay, famous for its angling. It's also the main water source for over 2,000 local families in the Strenuden Group Water Scheme.
This is a source lake, so it's about 59 hectares, and it basically runs from Carcahan to Clontibert, back over to near Annamullen to Hamlet.
But the quality of the raw water pre-treatment is under growing pressure due to excessive use of a pesticide spray used domestically, but also used mainly by farmers to kill weeds like dockens, rushes and thistles on pasture land.
There's urban pressures, the likes of the wastewater treatment and a one-off surge from domestic households, but farming would be the most contributory factor in the pollution of the water.
So in response, this pilot strategy of mitigation has been rolled out across the catchment area of the lake.
Our catchment is about 129 kilometres squared, so it is.
Ross MacDonald is the Source Protection Officer with Strenuden Group Water Scheme, and we spoke at the edge of the Windy Lake Shore.
You're talking about the invertebrates that live in those waters, under the stones, and that they're going to be affected if the water is contaminated with a high nutrient load or pesticides, which is, I suppose, is our main target at the moment. So it is, given the spraying season that we're going into, like, you know. So, and that obviously has a bigger effect on the fish then that feed off those invertebrates and so on, like, you know. So you're talking about the water quality diminishing. You have poor status water here, so you have, because of the nutrient load, because of human contributions, if you want, like, you know. We're drinking this water, Damien, you know, and the human health, it's not good. Obviously, we treat the water in the group water scheme and we get it out as well as we can, like, mm-hmm. you know. So we basically pump the water from here 9 kilometres, basically uphill the whole way. So we do. We treat it then, so we do. And then we gravity feed it to our customers, basically. It'd be regarded as good drinking water supplies to Newton Group Water Scheme, so there would be a respect to the water that's coming out of the tap, certainly from members, like, you know.
So here's what's happening. Farmers who have boom sprayers, those wide-winged bars that span out either side from behind the tractor to spray the weeds, are having them checked for faults, because even the tiniest damage can cause untold destruction to local biodiversity.
I contacted all the farmers and they were all too glad to have me come around, basically, and service and fit a low drift nozzle onto their boom sprayers. So every year they're going out and using a boom sprayer on different parcels of their land to treat weeds, whether that be the rush or whether that be the chickweed or whatever they're treating. And we wanted to make sure that they had the best technology available. So the spray coming from behind the boom sprayer was not going to go into the water. So that's basically why we've come up with this initiative. is Victor here.
That's Victor, how are you?
That's bad.
That's good.
Damien, this.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Victor Niblock is a beef and poultry farmer and also a member of the Strenuden scheme.
So, Victor, how aware are you now as a farmer in this area of, we'll say, your responsibility when it comes to protecting the quality of the water that's going into the group water scheme? Are you becoming more aware of it?
We are, yeah. We're becoming very aware of it. For instance, getting the sprayer all tested and set up with these new nozzles, which seems to be a good job. Like, it's important that we keep the water good because we're drinking it every day as a family.
Yeah.
And so we need it for our farm and for chickens. It's very good water.
Yeah.
And
you want to keep it that way, I suppose.
We do indeed, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
While we chat, Victor is having his boom sprayer and anti-drift nozzles checked for faults.
This is technology that should be used all over the place, as far as I'm concerned. Any technology that we can use to get less in the air and less in the water is only going to be beneficial for us with protecting the water. Can I get Arthur over to explain what he's doing here?
Yeah, yeah. Hello, Arthur. How are you?
Arthur Cairns of Chagask in Ballyhays College is overseeing the process of inspection, but also advising farmers on best practice when it comes to spraying.
If you're too big a pressure, it creates a mist or a drift, and that can travel for... Research has done 25 miles, it could travel in windy conditions.
Could it really?
Mm-hmm. Jim. Yeah.
25 miles?
Yes.
In windy conditions? Yeah. What you're spraying there, if the nozzles are not...
If the pressure's too high and the nozzles aren't correct and the sprayer's not calibrated properly.
Wow.
We the first sprayer we decided to test here, the farmer said he was ready to go to spray. It took us 6 hours to get the sprayer right. There's a lot of things has to be checked out.
Yeah.
And through time, sprayers do wear.
Right. And when they wear, what they're spraying goes further.
It goes further.
And it's not as direct.
Exactly. It's not doing the job it's meant to do.
So what are the most common faults with sprayers?
Leakages. Big problem. Faulty pressure gauge. Faulty nozzles. Would be the commonest ones. And the farmer's getting a free service too. He's getting his sprayer overhauled and maintained and extra wee bits put onto it. It's all free.
You know, anything with side at the end of it, herbicide, fungicide, insecticide, it sounds like a bad word when it comes to the environment, but is it necessary?
To a certain extent, you do need to control a certain amount of weeds. You know, they will take over.
But is there a safe level?
There is, of course, a safe level. And the starting off with, if you have the sprayers in good working order, the next thing then, the operator, if he calibrates his sprayer then, knows the speed of the sprayer, the speed of the tractor, the pressure to work at, the overlap of the sprayer, things like that. You know, so if the sprayer then is calibrated after we have it checked out, there's no reason why he can't be very accurate putting on applying the herbicide or the insecticide or the fungicide.
What sort of buy-in are you getting from farmers?
100% nearly of any farmer that I have talked to so far, Damien, is very well. There's no paperwork. There's no regulatory body here. I'm just somebody trying to improve the status of the water, and they buy into that. They want that because I suppose they're drinking this water. Their families are drinking this water. So it's in their interest too. And I suppose it gives me a chance to get beyond the cattle grid and make them appreciate the fact that this is something that can go into our aquatic environment, like, you know, especially with the kind of soils that we have, like, you know, which is useful for them.
Yeah, lovely man there, Ross MacDonald of Strenuden Group Water Scheme, on the strategy there to work with farmers locally to reduce the impact of pesticides on aqualife and biodiversity in their catchment radius. Group Water Scheme, so important to so many people around the country. Now, usually at this time of the year, early silage making will be well underway, but for anybody trying to grow grass or indeed grow vegetables in your back garden, you'll know the spring is a little bit late. There's been a lot of frost lately, and there's a situation developing now where farmers are preparing, obviously, to make silage over the next few weeks. But while there is a lull, Michael Moroney of the Association of Farm and Forestry Contractors of Ireland would like contractors and anyone planning to work with heavy machinery to think about social media. Michael's on the line. Michael, good morning to you. Explain what you're on about here. What do you mean about social media and videos going up online?
Good morning, Damien, and thanks for having me on. During last year's silage harvest, there was quite a number of videos posted on some of the social media sites, TikTok in particular, and Facebook, and they were portraying very dangerous activity by people involved in the silage harvesting. So we became aware that there was a growing problem of mainly younger drivers in contractor fleets who were, in a sense, breaking the law, in truth, by using handheld devices while driving a machine, but they're also putting their own lives and the lives of other road users at risk. And they do, to some extent, compromise the business, because accidents like this have effects throughout society, and they also impact on the business of the contractor operation.
And what sort of pranks were they up to, Michael?
Well, various pranks. We've seen some really dangerous activity. A guy jumping off the chute of a self-propelled silage harvester into a silage trailer. They were the ones that got most attention. And various guys sitting on bonnets of tractors as friends of theirs were driving them up and down the fields. So this is very, very serious activity, and it really undermines the seriousness. And it sort of puts aside any understanding of the operational risks associated with the skill of using high output modern machinery in a contractor operation.
And are we sure
I think the emphasis.
Are we sure that
a serious business?
Yeah, are
it
we
is
sure?
A serious business.
Are we sure that these videos were Irish?
Yes, we are indeed. Yeah, we're quite satisfied. In fact, during that period of time, I hadn't been a TikTok user, Damien, and I downloaded the app and became a TikTok user temporarily, and clearly could identify a number of people who were driving machines in Ireland, and we could identify them because their identity is part of the TikTok upload process.
We're well aware of the dangers to, you know, safety of doing this, but what are the implications for a contractor if somebody that's working for them is recording pranks on their phones?
Well, there are a number of implications, in particular for the person themselves in terms of driving the machines. They are putting themselves in danger, but they're also putting others in danger. And for the contractor who's running the business, this is a huge risk, because you are compromising people's lives and people's health. And as a result of that, you know, accidents do happen in these sort of situations, and ultimately the contractor's insurance policy will have to cover it. But it's more than that. It's the impact of these accidents that can have on people's lives forever.
Now, your organisation is suggesting that contractors, that they fire anybody whom they discover to be filming pranks like this or showing off like this on TikTok.
Yeah, it might seem like a serious move and a very strong move, but the dangers are so significant. And we, in the first instance, we are advising our members to have a type of toolbox talk before the harvest, to sit down with their drivers, even for an hour or so. They need to give them clear guidance about what is acceptable and what is not in terms of safety, and in particular in the use of mobile phones. And that's important that that's done now in advance of the harvest. It only takes about an hour or so, but it's a really important part of the system. And we need to see people doing this in advance. And that's part and parcel of their responsibility as employers, and as part and parcel of the responsibility attached to their safety statements.
Okay, and finally, Michael, are we a couple of weeks behind with the start of the silage season, as I was saying in the introduction?
We are a few weeks behind, and hopefully the rain that has come today will raise the temperatures, and I'm sure grass will shoot out of the ground even faster in the next week or so. But yeah, definitely, we're probably a week to 10 days behind due to the cold weather of the last 2 weeks.
Okay, and of course, if for the rest of us road users, if we don't have much patience, we're going to have to get them in the next few weeks, because there will be an awful lot of big tractors and machinery and trailers carrying grass from field to pit. So I suppose we just better be wary of that as well, and indeed contractors be wary of other road users as well. I'm sure that's something you'd reiterate. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Damien.
And as I said, it's a very timely message indeed to people not to get involved, because a lot of young people are employed for the summer, and it's great for them to have jobs like that, working for contractors, driving tractors. But if they're kind of peer pressured into doing these sort of dares, it's not very wise indeed. Michael Moroney, thank you very much indeed.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
Now, the pandemic restrictions are being gradually lifted, and on Monday week, the 17th of May, museums around the country will be able to open their doors once again to members of the public. The Old Garda Barracks in Cuttall, County Roscommon, will be welcoming visitors for the very first time as they open their John McGahan exhibition and reading room to the public. The writer and his six younger siblings lived in the barracks from 1944 with their widowed father, who was the local sergeant. Now, the Cuttall Community Development Group has worked tirelessly to remember the past life of the building while also providing a remote working hub and three hot desks to help ensure the future of the village. Mike McCartney visited the old barracks in Cuttall, where he met Maurice Gannon and Mary Fire, and he also had a tour of the building first, guided by Peter Griffin.
Though my father slept every night in the barracks, the guards, in their turn, had to leave their own families and sleep the night beside the telephone that hardly ever rang, even in the daytime. I cannot remember anybody coming to the barracks at night. If there was a sudden death or illness, people went to the priest or to the doctor if they weren't poor.
Good morning, Cuttall Garda Station.
Our famous writer John McGahan spent part of his childhood here, for his father was a Garda sergeant in this very barracks. Of course, over time when the barracks closed, it fell into disuse and disrepair, but the local community got together.
Familiar sound each night were the heavy boots of the barracks orderly taking down the bedclothes from the upstairs room to make up his bed for the night beside the phone. We'd hear the sounds of raking and blowing as he started the fire in the morning, and then the unlocking of the back door when he went down to empty his chamber pot and bucket of ashes into the ash pit over the river.
We're in the Garda day room, and this was the room. You access the building from the rear as you came in the door at the rear of the station. The cell would be on the left-hand side, and that's where anyone that was inebriated or perhaps waiting to be taken up to Dublin on charges or whatever, that's where they would be. And as you progressed through the rear hall, you came into this day room. This is the business part of the barracks. In John McGahan's days, other parts of the house were used as the living room and the kitchen. But latterly, when this place closed in 2012 as a Garda station, this was the only room that was actually in use.
The barracks itself was a strange place, like most of the country at the time. Though the Free State had been wrested in armed conflict from Britain, it was like an inheritance that nobody quite understood or knew how to manage. The Catholic Church was dominant and in control of almost everything, directly or indirectly. In a climate of suppression and poverty and fear, there was hardly any crime and little need of a barracks in a place like Cuttall, other than as a symbol.
Of course, in those days, there was no cars, and the bicycle was used by the guards and the sergeant to go out on their patrols.
And the bell still works.
And of course, it was interesting that one of the things that that John McGahan says in his books, or he had to contribute to the, what was called the patrols of the imagination, because I suppose there wasn't much crime. There was milk bottles bashed or smashed, but very little crime. So these guards would have to cycle up to 18 or 20 miles a day. Of course, there wasn't much happening, so they had to make up, a lot of the time, crimes.
We were able to tell the different guards by their sounds and footsteps. Sometimes in the morning they hummed or whistled, which always set my father muttering.
I see we've got a guard, the uniform, the sergeant's coat over here with the stripes and the baton, of
yes,
course.
That's the great coat that was used. That's from the period. We're very grateful, by the way, to the Garda Commissioner and John Reynolds in particular, who works for him, to supply many of the Garda artefacts. So they're original, they're of the period, and they're well worth seeing.
There's a rainbow that I can see, and it's waiting for me, don't forget me not, lad. Where are we now?
Well, we're actually in what was known as the living room, and now it's our John McGovern reading room, and strategically placed around the walls, in particular this wall that's got a headline, Becoming a Writer. One of John McGovern's famous sayings, why take on any single life, a priest, a soldier, teacher, doctor, airman, if a writer could create all these people far more vividly in that one life of the mind, the writer could live many times and all of life. I've not even the vaguest idea how books came into being, but this dream took hold and held.
Coming up to 2012, the realization was that the part-time guard station here was set to close down. So, you know, it was incumbent on us as the local representative group, if you like, to ensure that it was kept within the community, that it wasn't put on the open market as a residential property, and that we could use this as a community house, that we could commemorate John McGovern with an exhibition or a reading room, and basically renovate it and keep it for generations to come.
We have a lot achieved in the last 15 years as a group, with new people coming on board with ideas and plans for the village. So with this pandemic, you know, with the fundraising and the whole lot has came to a stall. So we're hoping, like, when we get back on our feet again, that we'll have our meetings and our get-togethers here in the barracks. You know, from remote working here and everything else, the pandemic has really been tough for the last year. Hopefully everything will work out itself, and that's seemingly where we're at, and it's been a great achievement for the last 8 years to get it up and running.
I wrote first without ever thinking of getting published. I think I was the first writer I met at that stage. And in a way, the writing was an extension of my reading. I do believe very seriously that there's not a great deal of difference between the artist and the reader. I think each of us has a private world that others cannot see. And it's with that world that we read. And that the difference between the reader and the artist is that the writer is able to dramatize that private world in his head. In a way, all good writing, I think, is suggestions. And it's not finished, it's not completed until it's taken up by the reader and then completed.
And that was the late John McGovern himself in a public interview with Miles Duncan on RT Radio 1. Now, thanks to the committee for permission to use excerpts from their launch video, including a welcome speech from former President Mary McAleese and readings by Niall Colleary about the barracks from the works of John McGovern. Of course, the local community has made huge efforts to raise money for this venture, and they have been helped by local businesses and the Roscommon Leader Partnership along with the County Council. And if you'd like more information about the exhibition, the website is mcgovernbarracks.ie. When it comes to delivering a speech, there are some people who are just made for it.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you?
Dukas Lin Niv Fodrig, August Thresha Liv Manona Heron, Abula Bwilla, Nia Wan Vur Sun Fain, Ocker Sun Karth on Dinna.
A creed at the core of every American whose story is not yet written. Yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can.
But for most of us, the idea of standing up in public to make a speech can fill us with dread.
Reverend ladies, gentlemen, men, I would like to welcome you all to the wedding consent reception.
This is only the second time I've ever been a best man. I hope I did the job all right that time. The couple in question are at least still talking to me. unfortunately, they're not actually talking to each other. The divorce came through a couple of months ago.
Well, in many cases, it can't be avoided, particularly when it comes to delivering a eulogy for a loved one. John Keating is a public speaking coach and helps people with speaking in public and in particular with delivering a eulogy. And he joins me now from Cork. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Damien.
What was it Mark Twain said about speeches?
Mark Twain. Well, put it this way. If I was to ask your audience out there this morning a question, and if they would raise a hand to the question if they answered yes, my question would be, have you ever experienced a fear of public speaking either in the past or presently? And I would guess many people would put their hands up. And Mark Twain captured that very well. He said, 97% of people have a fear of public speaking. And the other 3% are liars.
Something
I think we all experienced.
Yeah. So in other words, everybody, there's nobody that's ever stood up and made a speech, probably including President Obama there, for example, that wasn't somewhat nervous.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what do people fear most about standing up in front of people to deliver a speech?
Well, the technical term is glossophobia. Glasso being Greek for tongue, and so we get tongue-tied. I think the number one fear, and research backs this up, is that it's the fear of being judged and being judged negatively, you know, coming across maybe not as very bright. And that's a major fear. And there's a fear of standing up and nothing coming out. But there are other aspects then as well in terms of certain situations. For example, you know, where there might be a high degree of evaluation between a student and a professor. You have situations of status where I suffered from in the 90s as a manager reporting to a director. That type of situation was a big problem. There's also the huge problem of no experience. Mm-hmm. And we're not taught in primary schools or secondary schools or colleges or generally in the workplaces how to speak. There is the expectation, because we can speak, we can stand and speak. I mean, that's like saying to somebody who has got fingers, they could belt out a Beethoven piano concerto. You know, it doesn't happen that way. You know, we don't have the experience. So it is a skill. It has to be learned. And if we're not able and haven't got, you know, we've got to learn how to craft that speech. We've got to know how to deliver it. So there's all those elements that come into making it a fairly daunting experience. Yeah. And eulogies in particular, because, you know, we have so little time to prepare.
Yeah, because if you're asked to be a best man or father of the bride, you have time to prepare. But as you said, not when it comes to a eulogy. And we're going to focus just on that for now, because your interest in speech writing and eulogies in particular is something very personal to you, John.
Yeah. Sadly, my wife passed 16 years ago. And I mean, even at that time, you know, the day of she passed or the day after, the idea of eulogy hadn't even entered my head. And it came up for discussion, and I thought, oh, right. So I had to get a few words together. I incorporated a poem into that, but I knew I couldn't deliver that. I couldn't stand up and deliver that. There's just absolutely no way I could do that. So I was very fortunate. A friend of mine, Paul, his father, Mr. O'Keefe, who sadly has passed, I asked him, would he deliver that? And he got up and he said, well, these are John's words, and he delivered it for me. Mm-hmm. And it was from that then, a couple of years later, after spending the first 2 years after my wife passed at home with the kids, I needed to get back out into the world. And a friend suggested joining a Toastmaster club, which I thought was strange, but I said, okay. And I got involved with Toastmasters, and that took me down a completely different path in terms of learning about speeches. I started my own club because the club I joined met at night, which wasn't good for my kids. So I started a club in Bishopstown on a Saturday morning in the library so I could bring it to the kids. And that club now is going since 2009. We're having our 500th meeting, I think, next Saturday. And then I went on to form other clubs like West Cork Toastmasters, right. Republic of Work, one for EMC. So it just took me off down that path, you know.
Sure, and I mean, that it was...
I didn't expect to go.
No, and just going back, I mean, your wife was very young. She was in her early 40s when she died. And as you said, you were left at home with two young children. And then you got involved in the Toastmasters. And now you're actually helping people in the situation that you were in then. What is the key to writing a eulogy?
Well, in research for that, I actually contacted Kevin O'Connor. He's a funeral director here in Cork, and you know, he hears eulogies every day, you know, every day of the week for years and years. And the essence of a good eulogy is, I suppose, to recognise, number one, it's not about you. It's about the person that's passed, but it's for the audience. So it has to be very audience-focused. And good stories, you know, finding out stories about the person. If you look back, I've put a lot of eulogies together. There's one Billy Crystal did, for example, for Muhammad Ali. It's a long eulogy, it's about 20 minutes long, but it's essentially five stories. Stories about the man himself.
And his personal connection with them. Just on that, how long should a eulogy be?
I think between 3 minutes and 10 minutes tops.
Okay. Because some of them can
be just a poem.
Yeah.
And, oh, yeah.
And as Maya Angelou said, know your audience, as you said there earlier. How important is it to know your audience and what's acceptable to say and what's not acceptable to say? I mean, should you settle old scores on behalf of your your relation who's in the casket in front of you?
Yeah, certainly that. And I mean, I think Kevin O'Connor was saying that he would hear a lot of eulogies where people are talking at the pulpit as if they were in a public bar, you know, forgetting it's a place of worship. So it needs to be personal. It needs to be light. It needs to be, if it can be humorous, great, but certainly not a place for settling old scores. It needs to be respectful, and it needs to be, as I say, about the person that passed, but it's for that audience, and you have to focus on that audience, and you have to recognise certain people in the audience. You know?
There will always be one family member or a close family friend asked to deliver a eulogy, and it puts a lot of pressure on them. But should they consult with other relatives before they actually put it together?
Absolutely. A friend of mine recently, he did a eulogy, and he put it to his siblings, and they said, don't mention that, whatever it was, you know, just don't mention that.
Right.
So yeah, and that's where you're going to get stories, you know. And if you have other brothers and sisters, you might want to, you might ask them for a story, and then make that part of their, and mention them, their connection. So it shouldn't be all just about your connections. It can be all about other families or other people's connections with the individual.
Now, I know you're putting a book together. It's due to be published soon. And I was reading through the transcript from it, and I was surprised to see that before your parents died, you had already started writing their eulogy. Is that not a little bit morbid and tempting fate?
No. And it's one thing I really want to get across to people, to think about it. I'm not saying write it out word for word, but certainly in relation to my dad, I certainly wanted to give that eulogy. And I had a few years of Toastmasters behind me now at this stage. But I just wanted stories. And I was able to talk to him about funny stories. And I just started putting things together. Now, other people I've written eulogies for wanted to be ready. They didn't want to stress, you know. When you take it, you lose somebody that's very close to you. Next minute, you've got a blank page. Then you've got maybe 2 days to put this together, you know, and a very important speech, you know, and it might be the only speech you ever give.
And in a lot of cases,
all I'm saying to people is, if you have a loved one, start putting the stories, start just thinking about them.
Right.
And writing them down.
Well, maybe, sure.
And it's just getting prepared.
Well, sure. Write the eulogy and deliver it to them before they die might be another option, because an awful lot of nice things about people after they die.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the idea of, and I would have loved to have done the this is your life sort of concept to my parents, and get everybody together and let them hear all the nice things to say while they're alive. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, it's a pity we say all these nice things when people are gone, and we don't say it to them when they're alive. But particularly eulogies, if people can prepare and get their ideas together, find out some nice poem that a person would like, would the person like to say something themselves?
Yeah. Well, listen, before we go, John, it's not all sadness and death. You do help people write speeches for weddings, and are fathers of the bride and best men, are they absolutely petrified when they get asked? Do you find that?
Fathers of brides generally do. I have great fun with fathers of bride because, again, a lot of the guys. I had one gentleman. He had sort of an undiagnosed Tourette syndrome. Every word would be F this and F that. How are you? I'm effing great. You know, what's the booklet? F, you know. So, His daughter was terrified at the idea of him giving a speech. So he reached out to me, and then we got to get to write it. But he never told his daughter. So on the day, he got up. He was well prepared. He was well practiced. And when I wrote the speech out for him, at the end of every sentence, I put in pause. So he knew to take a breath. And he delivered it. And the daughter was just shocked that the father got up and delivered it. Every father wants to deliver a speech and do well for his daughter. And being prepared and practiced and having it typed up in front of them, that girl was just absolutely shocked that her dad was able to stand up and speak for 5 minutes without cursing anything at all and to deliver a nice, clear eulogy. Well, Father of the Bride speech.
Yeah, well, if it worked for him in the way the way you describe it, it would work for anybody. Listen, John, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed. And I know your book, Time to Say Goodbye, it's going to be published later this year. And indeed, you've another one coming out in relation to wedding speeches as well. But for the moment, John Keating there in Cork, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. So there is light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. And good morning to any 55-year-olds who are up good and early to register for the vaccination. Well, I've still a good few weeks to go, thank God. Anyway, when we look back on these months of restrictions, many of us will just be glad that we kept the show on the road. Others will look back and knowing the months were a time of really positive change in their lives. One such person is Marion O'Reilly. She made the decision to apply to become a foster parent, and Brenda Donoghue went to meet her at her home in the heart of the countryside.
I think the countryside is a wonderful place to grow up. I mean, I would have grown up in the town, and I always had a want for the countryside, and I never want to live in a city or town again, ever. I love the space, the tranquility of it, the distance that you have between yourself and the next person, that isolation. I love it.
Marion lives in the heart of rural East Galway with her three children aged between 12 and 16 years. During the lockdown, she decided to apply to become a foster parent.
I mean, if it wasn't for lockdown, I wouldn't be sitting here with a story to tell today, really. As my kids were getting older, that mothering instinct was there to nurture, and I suppose that's what smaller children want. And my own kids were getting big and they were doing their own thing and they didn't need me as much, so I probably felt a little bit left out. And it popped into my head and I said, you know what, now is the right time for me to have I look at this and see, is it something that I can do?
To think about fostering, why did you think it was something for you?
I mean, it was laced with excitement and a little bit of, God, it's the unknown, and will I be good enough? Will it work out? What kind of kids would I get? Would it affect my own kids? There was lots of positives and negatives, but I still decided to go ahead with it and make the phone call and chat with Barry in Foster in First Ireland. Like, we all know what it's like to hit rock bottom, and we all know what it's like to get up and have someone to help you. I would have lost brothers. I would have lost my first child as well. So I know what it's like to be down. I know what it's like. I know what rock bottom feels like, and it's not nice. So that sense of love, that sense of care, and I suppose it's something that someone would have given me. So I just want to pass it on as well and be able to do that for a person. Something I can't do for people that aren't here anymore, but there's people here that I can do something for, and that's what I want to do.
And just after Christmas, the call came to say that two young children were on their way.
I just didn't know what to think. I had to pinch myself, and I kept going in and out of rooms, and I hadn't done anything, and I didn't know what to do because I didn't know what to expect. So I said, just calm down. Do you know, the house is fine. They're not coming here to inspect the house. They're coming here because they need somewhere to stay. So next thing, they were here, and I was standing at the door, and these two children get out of the car, and my heart, just seeing them, it was... You just wanted to nurture them and love them, because you could see in their face, you could see the pain, you could see, do you know what, what's going on here? It was heartbreaking. It really, really was. They came in and I suppose then it was trying to act, how do you act around these kids? Because remember, this is my first time. So I didn't want to overcrowd them. You know, we didn't all want to be up staring at them, you know. So we kind of gradually eased in and showed them in and brought them to their room and had some toys there for them and just gave them the remote to sit down and watch telly.
Her own children welcomed the idea, but there was some adjustment.
Dynamics of the house completely changed. We went from 3 to 5. My youngest son was no longer the youngest. You know, there was 2 others to think of, even setting up the dinner table. The dynamics of that and where people sat and bedtimes and tablets and internet. And I had to be careful to, do you know what, not exclude anyone or make anyone feel that it was going to be different from them. So it was all about balance. Now, it took a while to get that balance right, but so far we're not doing too bad. We all know the signs now when things are getting too much that we need to separate or go our own way and just take time for ourselves.
Claire Lone is a senior social work practitioner with Fostering First Ireland.
Foster families and foster carers are amazing people, you know, and they dedicate their lives to vulnerable children. You know, a lot of services maybe were pulled back during lockdowns, but at the same time, the greatest service that a vulnerable child can get is actually that of their foster family. The love and commitment, time and care that they give every day is what makes the greatest difference to that child. And to see that progress play out in a child's life is so rewarding.
I'm thinking about Marion and Marion making that decision during the pandemic that she's going to foster. How great is the need for people like Marion to come forward?
You know, it's ever increasing. There's almost 6,000 children in care in Ireland and 90% of those are in foster care. And it's great that 90% of those children's needs can be met in foster care. We're not looking for the idealistic view of a family in an urban area. We're looking for real people with an open heart. And whether that's a single person or a married couple or a person that has children or a person that doesn't, it's about their qualities and what they can offer to fostering. You know, families in Ireland now are very diverse, you know, and life is diverse. And that's what we're looking for in fostering. And that's what children need. A lot of the children that I work with are placed rurally. You know, I cover rural areas. But, you know, it's like the show, Brenda, it takes a community to raise a child. And I've certainly seen rural communities wrap their arms around young people that have been placed with families in the area. And I have seen them absolutely thrive.
4 months on and fostering has made a difference.
The 2 kids that came in, just to watch them progress from the first day they came through my door. Just, and I'm not talking big things, simple things
like
getting dressed in the morning, tidying your room, learning to cycle. Just to see them progress with the little things, it gave me a sense of fulfillment and happiness just to watch that, even just to see them outside running and giggling with my own kids. Like, it's a beautiful thing to see.
That was Marion O'Reilly ending that report there by Brenda Donoghue. Fostering First Ireland is at ffi.ie. And this Wednesday, they're having an online information session at 5:30 in the evening explaining how you can apply to become a foster parent, just like Marion. You can get more information by contacting their details, as I said, on their website. That's all we have time for this week. Don't forget, playback is coming up after the 9 news here on Radio 1. Today's programme was produced by Eileen Herron, broadcast coordinator Brian Moss. Sheila Neville was on sound. Until I talk to you at the same time next week. Bye-bye and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.